the wealthy debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand, we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. Shall we what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America. North to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. It's a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to telling the American people and people around the world the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. Our guest today is Paul Salahuddin Armstrong. He's been on a couple of times before. He's an Islamic expert who lives in the London area. He frequently appears on television and radio and in live appearances. Now, the reason that I've had Paul on several times is that, of course, we are having a serious problem with Islamophobia, the fear of Islam. Like most fears, this is based on misunderstanding and ignorance. So Paul comes on the show periodically to educate people about what Islam is really about. Now, some people say that when you say that Islam is a religion of peace, that you're distorting the true Islam. People who claim to be experts at this are mostly not Muslim, which to me doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. I don't know why so many Americans listen to them when we have experts like Paul available to talk about what Muslims think. There are critics of this whole approach of calling Islam a religion of peace, and some people say that's a cotton candy view. And I'm quoting an Atlantic article that explored in depth the philosophy of ISIS, or Islamic State, claiming that this is just as valid as any other interpretation of Islam. Paul, first of all, welcome to the show. But just right off the bat, what do you say to that if people say, well, this is just as valid as any other interpretation of the Quran?
You can't say something is just as valid when it's historically not been the understanding of Islam. It's not the understanding of Islam through the 20th century, and it's not the understanding of Islam and most Muslims today. So, you know, this is a very, very tiny group of people that are understanding Islam in that way.
Well, let's dissect the argument in this article, because I found it more sophisticated than the usual arguments I hear to justify the claim that we should all be afraid of Islam. Although, by the way, he didn't say that. This, though, is what you can read into the article, and I think a lot of people that I've talked to have read it. This has been a very widely read article, and so I think it's important that we address it. Anyway, he says that ISIS bases their argument on what's called the prophetic methodology. They don't just look at the Quran, but they look at the actions of the Prophet Muhammad and the other early leaders of the religion, and they say that's what we should follow. Now, you've already sort of addressed this. You talked about, well, that's historical, it's evolved. But what do you say when people say, well, you know, every Muslim has to believe everything that's in the Quran, so how can you tell us that's not true now?
Muslims do obviously have the Quran at the center of their faith. It doesn't matter which group of Muslims we're talking about, whether Sunni or Shia or any of the other smaller groups. But how different people understand various verses of the Quran does vary. Just like you find within Christianity, how Catholics understand certain verses in the Bible is not going to be the same as how Protestants will understand the same verses. And then within the Protestants, you're going to have differences between Episcopal and Methodist and Baptist and the various other groups. And the Mormons, which do the same, and they also have another book. Obviously, you can't generalize all that and say that they all have the same interpretation, when there's clearly different interpretations. And it's no different for Muslims with regards to the Quran and the Hadith. I mean, Sunnis and Shia, for instance, even have different Hadith books that they refer to, you know, in addition to the Quran. And some Muslims reject all Hadith. And then you've got other Muslims which put a lot of emphasis on Hadith. So,
Paul, for our listeners who don't have a background in Islam, what is Hadith?
Hadith is the sayings or accounts of things that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, did within his lifetime. You know, whereas you will find some extremist groups will pick up some ridiculous Hadith, which, you know, other Muslims would be using.
Of course, we see that in all religions where people will use the power that the faithful grant them to abuse that faith. So, I just want to say that it sounds to me like this is comparable to the, I'm not that familiar with Judaism, but the Mishnah, is that the correct term?
Yeah, there is a lot of similarities between the way Muslims approach their scholarship and the way that rabbinical Judaism approaches its scholarship. And you have, for instance, within Sunni Islam, four main schools of thought, four madhab. There would even be different positions on various things, what the religion says on food, for instance, within these different groups. So, for instance, you've got most of the madhab accepting that anything caught from the sea, which is edible, is halal. It's permissible to eat. But then again, you know, the Hanafis say, no, this only applies to fish, and you can't eat shellfish. Whereas if you're a Shafi or a Maliki, you'd have no problem eating prawns. You also find similar things within rabbinical Judaism. And that was one of the beauties of Islam in the past, that you had people discussing various things and, you know, they'd come to different opinions, but they would respect one another and say, well, I don't agree with his conclusion, but because of the methodology he used, I have to accept that it's a valid conclusion, even though it's not the same as mine. So we have to agree to disagree. And that's sadly one of the things which we're losing now with this Saudiization of Islam. They're trying to say that Islam is a monolithic entity. And then, but if they want to push forward just their view, their particular Wahhabi Salafi interpretation, to the exclusion of all others, and this couldn't be more un-Islamic. This is not what we've seen throughout the history of Islam, and it's not what most Muslims believe today.
Well, yeah, you were touching on a lot of things I want to go into in a little more depth. But before we go on, I just want to say that don't want to get lost too much in the details of the theology, which I find fascinating, but some, I don't want to lose our listeners who may not be following everything. The main point here, though, is that there are a very wide variety of different versions of Islam that are based on different interpretations of the Quran and the Hadiths. They range all the way from the extremist of the extreme ISIS type interpretations to the Wahhabis, which this article says is not quite as strict, all the way to the Sufis, which is very non-dogmatic version of Islam. You want to mention just something about Sufism?
There's different types of Sufism. There are today even some Sufis which have sort of almost cut themselves off from Islam and they just follow a kind of Sufism. But historically, Sufism was an aspect of Islam. It doesn't matter what other kind of, you know, the other groups that I mentioned previously, and whether it's people are Sunni or Shia, they would actually have a Sufi aspect to what they're following anyway. It's a little bit like within Judaism, you've got the rabbinical scholars of Judaism, and then you've got the spiritual Jews, you know, but actually a lot of Jews would follow like Kabbalah, and they would also follow a rabbinical school. In the same thing within Islam, a lot of people would follow Sufism for their own personal spiritual development, but they would also adhere to a madhab, a particular school of religious law, if you like. For the other aspects of the religion, like going to the mosque, how they would observe their prayers, what they would eat, what clothing choices they would make. And that's not to say that there's a particular kind of dress that people have to wear, but just guidelines that, you know, they would actually apply to their dress. And that comes into the jurisprudence, the legalistic aspect of the religion. But Sufism is the faith aspect. That's the side that is akin to grace within Christianity. We believe as Muslims that if you don't have both, that you lose balance. So historically, you know, Muslims are encouraged to study both aspects of Islam and not go too much into the legalistic area or too much into the spiritual area, but to maintain a balance between the two.
So when you say spiritual, let me just make sure I understand this. You mean the sort of mystic aspects that you can't really pin down to the word of the Quran or to some scientific concept, but more when you relate these to the Quran and maybe the hadiths, you're really doing some more loose less literal interpretation. Is that correct?
It is less literal, but it's very important to stress that this goes back to the early days of Islam. It's not something that someone just brought along. And you can even find things in the lives of the companions of Prophet Muhammad and within Prophet Muhammad's life himself that indicate that they had this system in place already. And it was just built on through the ages. It wasn't something that was, you know, because the reason I made that point is because you find a lot of the Wahhabis and ISIS and Al-Qaeda and these types, they try to make out that the Sufism is some kind of Greek philosophy that was pinned onto Islam. But the historical record proves otherwise.
I'm glad you made that point. That's kind of what I wanted to get to next. This is because of this, what you call the Wahhabization of Islam, the increasing tendency towards a sort of, I guess you could say, fundamentalist interpretation. Because of that tendency, the Sufi have been increasingly not just marginalized, but actually persecuted in some areas. Isn't that correct?
Very much so. I mean, one of the first things, a lot of these groups, whether it's Boko Haram or Shabab in Somalia, or ISIS, or the Taliban in Pakistan, they tend to smash up Sufi shrines, which is like when we bury people that are regarded as quite saintly Muslims, they would be buried in a tomb. And that would become a place of pilgrimage to people who revered that saint. And these places have been utterly demolished. A lot of Sufi mosques have been destroyed. So, you know, they utterly disrespect Sufi. They regard us as kuffar, as being, you know, absolute infidels. In some respects, you could say they even hate Sufi Muslims more than they hate Christians and Jews and people that are outside of the religion, because they certainly treat Sufis that way.
Right, and we see the same thing with the Ahmadiyya, which is another sect of Islam, and then even the entire branch.
But it's important to stress, Sufism is not a sect. It is an aspect of Islam.
That gets to sort of the central point here, is that all of these are interpretations of Islam. They are all Islam, which is one of the points of the article. Even the ISIS philosophy, they say, is Islamic, although it's far, far from the mainstream. As the article itself says, most Muslims reject this extremist version. And yet there's this fear among a lot of Americans, and I would say it's fair to say especially fundamentalist Christians, but also a lot of people who are not Christian. There's this fear of Islam that somehow not only is it something to be afraid of, but they think that people in the U.S. government are trying to impose Sharia law in the United States. Now, I know you follow this kind of thing. What's your observations about that?
Well, in Denmark, they're banning halal food, so it doesn't seem to me very plausible. I've spoken to people in the UK as well who think the same thing. I reach out to them and have conversations to try to figure out where they get this idea from, and to try and build an understanding. And there was one person I was speaking to, and he thought that they were going to put Sharia compliant kitchens in schools, and that the government was paying a huge amount of money to do this. I said, look, I tell you what, if there was any truth to what you said, I would be on your side condemning it. And he was shocked. He was, what? And I said, no, seriously. I said, that's absolutely an outrageous waste of public money. And that's surprised him. It wasn't the answer he was expecting. But of course, his next response was, I must be lying. No, I'm not. You know, I'm a British citizen. I pay taxes. And, you know, I don't want to think that, you know, money is being frittered away on irrelevancies that don't make any sense from a religious standpoint, never mind anything else.
We hit this point several times. What is Islamic? What's not Islamic? That in itself is kind of a controversial question, isn't it, in Islam?
It is. There were various doctrines or creeds that were written down. A bit like, I mean, for Christians, you have the Apostles' Creed. You know, there's certain teachings that virtually all Christians will cling to. And if somebody says something else besides that, that is really contradictory, but then you could pretty safely say that that person wasn't a Christian. You know, for instance, let's say someone says that there was another Jesus, you know, and you have to believe in that person to be a savior, then that would go against the Apostles' Creed. It wouldn't be something which a Christian could subscribe to. In a similar way, within Islam, we have certain creeds, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but just to mention, for instance, the Ash'ari Creed or the Aqidah At-Tahawiyyah. These particular documents give a sort of a list of the things that at that particular time it was written that Muslim scholars agreed upon. They might disagree on everything else, but on those particular points, the foundation of the faith, they agreed on those things. And we do have that within Islam. So, I mean, if somebody says something really ridiculous and outrageous that goes against it, we can pretty safely say that that person is on something else. Besides these central teachings, then there is a lot of openness within Islam, a lot of flexibility. And again, this is one of the beautiful things about the religion, and one of the appeals, you know, that it's not something which locks you into a particularly narrow-minded worldview. You can be very open-minded and be a Muslim.
Okay, I would say that's true of all the great religions, to some extent or another. But what I was really getting at is specifically within Islam, there's a term for people that run around accusing other people of not being Muslim. That's takfir. Can you talk a little bit about that, where it comes from, and why it's so important?
Mostly, this problem has emerged in the last couple of centuries because of the teachings of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And this was a guy who lived just under 300 years ago in what is now Saudi Arabia. And in his time, the main scholars in the Muslim world, when they heard of his teachings, they branded him a dangerous heretic. So, you know, this is how serious the guy was. And even his own father and brother condemned his teachings as heresy. So, you know, he wasn't a popular guy. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he made a deal with the Al Saud family, who later on become the kings of Saudi Arabia, you know, he would have disappeared into anonymity and it would have just been some small, irrelevant little sect. But of course, because of this deal he struck with the Al Saud, and he basically made some agreement that he would leave the royal family alone and support the royal family.
Yeah, that really shows again the problems of mixing politics and religion. We saw that with the Sanhedrin in Israel, who made deals with the Roman Empire. We saw it with the Catholic Church, which was basically founded by an emperor who got a bunch of people together in Nicaea and decided what the Bible said. And of course, nothing was left in there out of all the different things written about Christ and his teachings. Nothing was left in there that would contradict the divine right of kings. So this is another example of how a major religion has been politicized. It's a little different in Islam, though, because as in the early Jewish religion, the religious leadership and the political leadership were both imbued in the prophet. So that's a bit of a different tradition compared to Christianity, where they traditionally separate the secular and the religious. There's the famous quote.
But if I may, Rick, there's something I want to point out on this that sure. many people don't realize. This idea of separation of church and state came to Europe through Averroes. Averroes was also known by an Arabic name, Ibn Rushd. He was an Islamic scholar. It's a shame that a lot of countries in the Muslim world didn't adopt this great Islamic scholar's teachings, and it was instead adopted in Europe and in the United States. But he basically realized the problem of, you know, the dangers of when you give the same power to religion and political leadership and mix it together. So he advised it to be separated. And this also has an early precedent within Islam, because Prophet Muhammad was a prophet before he went to Medina. He was already preaching. He was already known by the time he was invited to Medina as an arbiter between different warring tribes. He was already known as being a great sage, an honest and wise person. So these tribes that had been fighting each other for a very long time, they wanted peace. So they invited him, can you come? Because you're from a different city. You're regarded as a very wise and holy person. You're neutral. You're not from either of our tribes. So can you come to our city and help us, you know, sort this out? And that's what Muhammad did. There was a constitution that was drafted in Medina, which recognized the Jewish tribes as citizens, even pagan citizens of Medina as all being citizens, even though they were not following Muhammad on his religious teachings. So it's like he was wearing two hats, one as a religious leader and one as a political leader, almost like a president today. And there was a difference between how he addressed the different disputes depending on whether they were religious or whether they were political. I mean, it must have been a really difficult challenge for him to bear, to be able to carry these two very different roles. And he tried to separate them, which is incredible and well ahead of its times. And so because of this, there are a number of people within the Muslim world who do point to that and say, look, to have a separation between religious institutions and the state is something that the Prophet Muhammad himself encouraged us to do. And of course, you know, people twist things. They twist the teachings, just like people within the Christian world have twisted the teachings of Jesus to suit agendas very opposite to Jesus' teachings. You'll find the same thing within the Muslim world, where people find whatever they can to suit their own agendas. This is why education is so vitally important, so that people are inoculated against that and don't go down some crazy road which leads to destruction like ISIS.
Well, that is fascinating. I'm glad you explained that to me, because I never knew that bit of history or really thought about the Prophet's roles that way. But, you know, it also occurs to me, I mentioned earlier that in Israel there was this theocratic state where the high priests were actually de facto rulers, or at least quisling rulers of Israel. Rome, of course, was the real ruler. But the Jews also rebelled against that system, too, and established the rabbinical tradition, and they did separate religious leadership from political leadership. So I mentioned earlier, and I want to clarify this point that I made, Christ said the two things need to be separated. And I'm getting that from the famous quote, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Trying to separate the political from the religious. To me, that's pretty clear. And yet now you have these fundamentalist Christians in the United States who are trying to impose their religion on the people through the law and the government. Now, that's exactly what you're saying, is that's exactly the opposite of what Muhammad did. He clearly felt these two things were separate. He did not impose his Islamic beliefs as law on the Jews and the pagans in Medina. So there, he's actually set a good example for separation of church and state, not conflation of the two, not theocracy. Excellent point, Paul. Thanks for explaining that to our listeners here. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about what Sharia is. Again, that's the big bugaboo for these Christians who think that Sharia law is being imposed in the United States by a so-called Muslim, also known as a radical, what do they call him? A radical Christian and a Muslim, President Obama. anyway, what do we mean by Sharia law? Well, give me some examples of what that means. Why should we be afraid?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, to be honest, if it's someone like Anjem Chowdhury, again, a nobody who keeps being interviewed by the BBC, even though he's only got about 16 followers, then if somebody advocated putting his interpretation of Sharia law, you know, in any kind of influence, I would be scared as a Muslim, you know, because it's very, very far from what I understand. And the same is true of what they implement in Saudi Arabia, or what Daesh, ISIS, implements in their so-called, you know, un-Islamic state. But Sharia itself is a word that means road.
Okay.
And there's two words that are used by Muslims. One is Sharia, one is Tariqa. You know, the one is about a wide road, and the one is about a narrower road. And the idea within the spiritual tradition of Islam is that there's one road that is internal towards your heart. This is the spiritual one. This is the narrower one. So we be harsher upon ourselves. But the Sharia is the wider road. So it's guidelines for the society. Now, that doesn't mean that we impose upon people who are of different faiths, of different beliefs, things which they could not possibly accept and which would be unjust to impose upon them. Within the Ottoman Empire, and I wouldn't necessarily agree with everything the Ottomans did, because I'm a 21st century Muslim. I'm not a 19th or 18th or 17th century Muslim. But even within their system, they had like positions for the chief rabbi, the chief priest of the Christian group, and as well as the mufti of the Muslims. And these were all under the Sultan. But the Sultan was a secular ruler, and these were the religious rulers. And they had their own councils for their own religious communities. So it was a large extent of autonomy was given to the different religious groups within the society. Now, I'm not suggesting we impose that today, because we hopefully can move on from that and have equal citizens within society in a model that we're developing within Western countries. But at the same time, it was really advanced for the times that this was introduced. And it was way ahead of what anyone was doing in Christian-dominated Europe. Because these various communities could basically do their own things without having the state imposing upon them the guidelines from the other religions. They had that degree of autonomy. And only if it was something which transgressed the rights of another group, then they would have to appeal to the Sultan. And, you know, then it becomes something which, you know, but if it's something else that's within their own community, they've got their own laws. They had their Jewish laws or their Christian laws, which they could deal with these issues. And as long as it didn't cause a trouble within the society, it didn't have to go to the Sultan. They could deal with it themselves, which was rather good for the times, you know.
They could deal with it at the local level. So even though there was general common law throughout the caliphate, there was also local applications of the law. Is that what you're saying? So that people could actually self-determine at the local level, as opposed to having it imposed?
Something much more along those lines, yes.
Okay.
Because you've got to bear in mind as well, when the Ottoman Empire started, it was predominantly a Christian empire.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I did not
know
that.
The Christian citizens were generally happy with that arrangement. There are even stories of Christian cities that were actually inviting the Muslims to come in because their own rulers were so corrupt. And they preferred the rulership of some of these Muslim rulers that were less corrupt than their own and would still give them their own rights and allow them to go to their churches and allow their priests to remain in their positions. Which, you know, it's hard to believe today because of all the propaganda we've heard and you know, the things, even the Ottomans have been dragged through, you know, a lot of bad stuff has been said about the Ottomans, and they've been made out to be far worse than what they actually were in reality. Well, again, this goes back to historic conflicts between European countries and between the Ottomans, which were political. They had nothing to do with, you know, religious differences or any genuine superiority between Ottoman Turkish civilization or Viennese civilization or the German civilization or anything like that. And if you look at the same time as to what the people on the other side were doing, you know, it was just as bad or perhaps even worse. So, you know, these were, you know, people have a tendency when they look back at history, they say, ah, but this happened. Yeah, but what were we doing in England at that time?
Mm-hmm. You know? I think that's an excellent point. People need to realize that, you know, they think that religion is the cause of wars. And it sounds like what you're saying, and I certainly believe, that religion is more an excuse for wars sometimes. But it's only one of many causes. And ultimately, always, it's about control of resources. I mean, if that weren't involved, I don't think people would risk their lives in the Crusades, for instance.
But the Crusades was definitely about resources.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at the poverty that was in France and in Britain at the time, and then you look at the prosperity that they were experiencing in the Middle East.
Right.
And of course, the Pope and his minions wanted a slice of that.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, and they also wanted
the times, I guess.
Yeah, and one of their first objectives, they said they wanted to go to Jerusalem, but that's through Constantinople, now Istanbul,
yeah.
And that was a big objective, was to capture that again. That's where the.
And of course, the other thing to bear in mind about those times is that people paid a tithe to the monastery,
uh-huh.
And that money went to some of it went to the local bishops and cardinals, and whatever didn't went to the Pope. So the kings, they didn't get much. Yeah, when you look at why King Henry VIII in the United Kingdom did what he did and made the separation from Rome, everybody says it's about a divorce. Well, that was part of it because he was thinking, I'm the king, you know, I should be able to get a divorce if I want. But it was then he started thinking about other things. And it's interesting because he remained religiously Catholic throughout his life. You know, people don't realize that. So spiritually, he was still a Catholic. And this is why the Church of England to this day is still a very Catholic religion, especially within the High Church tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he realized that all the money was getting going from England to Rome. And whatever was left in England was going to the Roman Catholic bishops within England. So there was very little left to actually develop the society. And it was only after they made that severance with Rome and that the taxes started going to the government instead, that then you started to notice Oxford and Cambridge being developed, the famous universities,
uh-huh.
that were actually also important because you need knowledge in order to be able to build and develop a society. And from them came a lot of things. And not only that, other schools across the country, business centres started to be developed, you know, the markets, the town centres, the Shakespearean theatres, basically the things that we now recognise as, you know, the bastions of Anglo-American society, that's where they started.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't have been for that severance from Rome, there wouldn't have been the funding to be able to do it.
That is fascinating to me. Another piece of history I didn't know. Thanks for educating me about that, Paul. Well, let's get back a little bit to Sharia, though, because there are still some there's a couple
of ways. In a way, if you think about it, it's got a similarity to what happened in America when the early American colonist says, well, hang on a minute. Why are we giving all our taxes to London?
Yes, exactly.
Now, if we give all our taxes to London, what are we going to have left here to develop our own states?
You know, that's a great point, Paul, because a lot of what we talk about on this show is about, they're all themed around the theme of corporate control of the U.S. government. Another way of looking at that is we're talking about a very small group of very wealthy and influential people who all sit on each other's boards of directors on these international corporations, and they can contribute so much money to elections that they basically choose the majority of our members of Congress and our president, or at least tell us who we can choose from, and they're all friends of theirs. So this is a small group of people imposing their will from the top. They don't pay taxes, but we pay taxes. And where's that going to? You mentioned that education, schools, and things like that are the basis of a modern Western society, the Anglo-American tradition of the great democratic society. Well, when they start to take those things away like they're doing now, and we're still paying the taxes, then we're getting back to a system where basically we're tithing to a small group of people who want to control the world, like the Pope did at one time, largely controlled the world. So it's important that people realize, you know, it's very easy to demonize Islam or the Catholic Church or the President of the United States or Israel. But really the problem is that we are not holding people responsible for their own behavior. And that should be the basis of any religion, I would think. I mean, that seems to me that that's the basis of Christianity, is we all have to be individually responsible. It's a very popular concept, except we don't apply it to our own leaders. And
it's the concept of rule of law, isn't it? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how rich a person is, what their position, if they break the law. I mean, in theory, in our system, if Her Majesty the Queen in this country broke the law, we could take her to court.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That comes from Magna Carta, when the barons forced Prince John, who was being very corrupt, to concede and to recognize that he was also a human being, and he had not just rights but responsibilities. And if he didn't adhere to those responsibilities, then he too could be held accountable. And this is the problem. I mean, I've got nothing against rich people personally, but when those rich people don't give back something to the society and don't contribute, or they think that they can act above the law, that is a problem. And if it's not dealt with, your society's finished.
Well, that's absolutely true. And it is, it's true that that's what's happening right now. There's a lot of reasons. I mean, there's the worship of wealth. There's a lot of confusion about how capitalism works itself. There's this mythology that anybody that works hard enough can get rich. Well, that's mathematically impossible. And one of these days, Paul, I want to get you on.
And it's not as if that some of the people who are getting rich necessarily because of hard work. I mean, I'm not saying that in all cases some people do work hard and they get rich, but in some cases it's because they happen to just invest in the right thing, and it was money creating money. Well, is that really work?
That
Or even some people that are getting paid absolutely ridiculous amounts for just being a good sportsman.
Well, that's the basis of capitalism.
I'm not saying they shouldn't be, you know, given some remuneration for that. But when they're earning far more than people who are developing the medicines that are going to save us from tomorrow's deathly illnesses, then there's something seriously wrong.
Well, Paul, when you talk about people making money off of money and not having to work for a living, that's the basis of capitalism. That's one way to define it. It's you're using your capital, your accumulated money, to make more money. And if there's no limits on that system, even Adam Smith said this, if you don't regulate that, you're going to end up with a fascist government or a fascist society. And that's essentially what you have when corporations are the government. And increasingly, that is what's happening in the United States, in Great Britain, all throughout Europe. And they're trying to impose their will on the rest of the world. That's what this show is about, and that's what we're trying to fight. And one of the things that people need to realize is that when we make assumptions about other groups of people, when we start thinking in terms of us versus them, they've already beaten us. Because when it's us versus them, then we're fighting each other instead of them.
That's the old thing, divide and rule.
Absolutely. And it strikes me that one of the central tenets of Islam is that we should all be one people. I mean, it's sort of a central tenet of Christianity. And
for
some
people like Quranic verses, it says in the Quran, we made you into a God, made us into nations and tribes that we might come to know one another.
There you go. It's about diversity, and it's about respecting diversity diversity of opinion, not just genetic diversity. We need that to survive. We need that to evolve. Just like we need to have biological diversity to evolve biologically, we need social, psychological diversity to evolve as a species. Now that it looks like our genetic evolution is over because we've conquered everything else, now the only thing that can kill us is ourselves. So I suppose you could say that if things keep going the way they are, we're going to evolve into a species of people who are so ruthless and cutthroat, the only ones that will survive are the ones that kill the other ones first.
And this is the point, this is the reason why I don't think religion in its pure sense is the problem, because all of the religions advise us to reflect on ourselves. How are we living our lives? How we want to be living our lives? And what kind of societies do we want to be living in? And they always encourage people to be compassionate and kind to their neighbors, preferably to love their neighbors. But at least if you can't do that, at least to have some tolerance and understanding and be merciful and kind. How is that a bad thing?
Well,
it's the warping of these teachings that's the problem, not those teachings themselves.
I couldn't agree more, and I think part of the problem, I think you really nailed something here. You said that one of the things that the great religious teachers, the Prophet Muhammad and Jesus and many of the Jewish prophets, tried to teach us is about how to build a better society, a society that more reflects these principles, that we care about each other. And in a sense, in some of the teachings, it's not just about be nice to other people so you'll be rewarded in heaven or whatever. It's be nice to other people because that helps you. You will live in a decent society that way. It seems so obvious. It's called enlightened self-interest. It seems so obvious to people like you and me, and yet you hear these religious leaders, at least the ones that get the most attention from the media, it's not about society. It's about individual responsibility, especially in the United States. It's all about individual behavior. You do this. You do that. You be a good citizen. Do what we say and don't question the system, and you'll go to heaven and get your reward there, because you sure as hell ain't going to get it here.
Which again, is another thing. I mean, theologically, I've thought about this a lot. I reflected on what it says in the Quran and also what other religions teach. And the way I see it is that heaven and hell are states of being. And whichever way our soul is, whatever condition our soul is when we leave this life, is what kind of spiritual condition it is in the next life. So, I mean, if somebody goes around doing terrible things to other people, some part of themselves is going to feel bad about that. Even if they try to deny it, even if they try to ignore it, and it's going to eat away at them. And this is why you often find people who are like that tend to be abusing alcohol or drugs or something else just to distract them, to take them away from those feelings. Because if they sat quietly and faced who they really are, they would be incredibly ashamed. And, of course, this is what, again, all the religious teachers taught us. They taught us to do that because they says if you don't do it here, you're going to have to do it after you leave this life. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be even more painful then. Whereas, I mean, if we face up to it here now, especially preferably while you're young, then you can actually change your ways and make amends for some of the things that you've done and be a force for good instead of bad. And, of course, a person who's in that condition is not worrying about these things. They feel good about themselves because they're not going around beating other people up or ripping them off or treating them appallingly. So they feel comfortable. And, you know, to me, that is like a taste of paradise or heaven in this life. And that's the ideal. That's the thing we should be striving for.
Well, I think that's what Jesus meant when he said, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, thy kingdom come.
That, exactly, yeah.
And, of course, Muhammad tried to teach the same thing. But let me get back to some of the more controversial stuff. We can sit here and agree with each other all day. But let me get back to one of the more controversial things. And
on about those sort of things, there was sure. Hadith, a saying of Prophet Muhammad that's being narrated, where obviously Medina during the early days, the reason why Prophet Muhammad did go on the battlefield, we can't deny that, but it was in defense of the community which he was made the leader of. So he had the responsibilities of a president or a king as well as being a prophet. A Buddhist friend of mine says, but look, he went on the battlefield. How can you follow someone like that? And I says, how could I follow him if he didn't? Because he was appointed to this position because of the respect people already had for him in Medina. And if when he was the leader of that community, he says, hey, I know that there's an army of 3,000 people coming to annihilate us, but we must all sit here and pray. Wouldn't he be incredibly irresponsible? So he organized a defense of the community that he was the head of. And, you know, but even when he was going onto the battlefield, there were some young men who actually came to him who were quite young and, of course, egoistic at that age. They wanted to fight, to show off. And he says, has your parents given you permission? And they says, no. He says, then go and look after your parents because that is your jihad. What does that tell us about the kind of person that Prophet Muhammad was? Was he a warmonger? Or was he someone who was trying to bring out the best character within human beings?
Well, let me just, I want to go a little deeper into this. You hit on exactly where I was going to go with this. The story of Medina, for people who don't know, Paul alluded to this earlier. In Muhammad was invited to Medina from Mecca after he had established his that he was a prophet. They invited him to advise them how to run their civil society. But the merchants of Mecca were very threatened by the popularity of Muhammad, and so they assembled a large army of 3,000 people to attack him. That's what Paul's referring to here. And that definitely was a defensive war that, according to legend, was that he won miraculously with a much smaller force of young men, old men, a lot of them. But anyway, but then, and this is the history I don't know anything about, Paul, but people tell me that he actually waged offensive war to spread Islam after that, later in his life. Is that true, or are you saying that's false?
I don't find that, not from my reading of it, sir, because after he went to Mecca with an army of 10,000 men, and not one drop of blood was spilled, you know, because obviously he went with overwhelming force because he didn't want to kill people in his own hometown where he lived.
Right.
So he was hoping that the, you know, you can see this logic now, because we use it now, even, you know, the Americans will take their best stuff, you know, if they want to go onto the battlefield, in the hope that they have to use it little rather than they have to bomb the hell out of someone.
Well, that's the way we did before Iraq anyway, and then they ignored
Iraq. I mean,
then they ignored that doctrine. Yeah.
In recent years, it's but you know, the principle is, the point I mean is, the principle is known to military tacticians today.
Right.
And it's I mean, it's renowned that he went there with 10,000 men, and he could have enacted revenge against those who would, it treated him appallingly, because when he was living in Mecca, he was oppressed. They treated him terribly. They murdered a lot of his companions or tortured them. You know, some of them had to go and seek asylum in Ethiopia. And, you know, this is how terrible his situation was. So, I mean, he would have had every reason to go back there and say, well, Abu Sufyan and your family, you're going to be executed for what you did. He didn't. He declared a general amnesty.
Right, and now I understand that's a very important point that people don't understand. So as a defensive war, as soon as it was won, there was an amnesty. Back then, it was typical you would slaughter the men that survived, or at least a good portion of them, and take the women and children as slaves.
Yes, it was.
And he did not do that. So he established really a new precedent. And you're saying that in future conflicts, they were also defensive, and he followed a similar pattern.
The ones within his lifetime, I see as defensive.
Right.
Of course, you know, afterwards, it was other people that came along.
Exactly.
And each ruler, you know, some of them were good, some of them were bad. Just like, you know, if you look at the history of Christian rulers.
Exactly.
Some of them were noble people that you could admire, and some of them were tyrants. And it was exactly the same within the Muslim world. And you know, this is why some people like Salahuddin Ayyubi, who fought against the Crusaders, but was also willing to make a treaty with them. You know, when they were backing off and they wanted to retreat, and he made a treaty and promised that their pilgrims would be safe within his land. And he allowed a lot of even the Christian soldiers who fought against him to either go home, or he allowed some of them to even settle in the Middle East. I mean, this is remarkable. He actually paid from his own coffers the voyage home of a lot of these poorer soldiers who were just left behind. You know, when the kings and the barons went and they wanted to go home, he actually paid from his own coffers so that they could go home. You know, and some of them that wanted to settle in the area, he gave them some land to settle. This was a very noble Muslim ruler. But of course, I mean, there were other Muslim rulers who were tyrants, who murdered people. But, you know, how closely were they adhering to the example of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or of people like Salahuddin Ayyubi?
That is such an eloquent response to that, Paul. That's exactly what I assumed, but I wanted to hear it from you. Muhammad did not wage offensive wars. Muhammad, in fact, laid down quite clearly the principles of a just defensive war and followed them in his lifetime. But then later on, of course, as you said, there's always rulers who will abuse religious authority and misinterpret what's clearly written by their predecessors, the prophets. They'll clearly misinterpret it for their own purposes. I also want to mention to our listeners, Paul was talking about Salahuddin there, his namesake. Salahuddin is a great hero of the Islamic world. He really organized the resistance against the occupation by the Crusaders and drove them out. And for that, he is highly revered in the Muslim world. And as Paul said, he was more than just a warrior. He really stood up for the people. He did what we would do, anybody would do, if their territory was invaded. People talk about how violent the Muslim religion is, and they don't look at the violence of a so-called Christian nation like the United States, which is running rampant all through the Muslim world. We've talked, Paul, a lot about ISIS here, and what we haven't said is that this sort of Wahhabi, Salafist, fundamentalist interpretations of the Quran have not only come because of a history of what happened in Saudi Arabia, but because of the support that the United States government has given that Wahhabi country, and the way that the United States has allowed, not just allowed them, but actually encouraged them to support this Wahhabi philosophy, because what's happened is it's resulted in a huge number of jihadists around the world who are willing to go and wage war, supposedly, for Islam. But what they're really doing, they're being manipulated by Saudi Arabia and other countries to try to attack countries that they don't like. And it's been observed by a lot of people that for some reason they never attack Israel. And now we're seeing Israel actually supporting Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, in Syria. This is even making the New York Times. So if it's there, it must be true, right? So this is the craziness of it. At home, Americans are taught to hate the Muslims, not realizing that their own government is creating this Wahhabist movement and encouraging it to spread so that the al-Qaeda and the IS offshoot can be used as proxy armies of mercenaries fighting for Saudi Arabia against Iran and Syria and Lebanon and for Israel and for Saudi Arabia, for Qatar. This, you know, if Americans understood this and if they realized that it's really all about corporate profit, we might just be able to do something about it. But it starts with getting rid of this us versus them philosophy and realizing that it's in our interest to understand people that they want us to think of as our enemies. Paul, I'm sorry to run on for so long. We just have a couple minutes left. Do you want to make some wrap-up comments here?
This is this is definitely a point that people have to bear in mind, because, you know, the enemy in inverted commas is always demonized. Whoever the state decides is the enemy at any given time. I mean, you look at the situation between America and Russia and how the Russians at various times have been demonized, and yet under Reagan, they were praised as being our friends, and now they're being demonized again. Now, obviously, there's basis for some of these things, but the exaggeration and the extent to which it's taken, you know, I mean, since when did the Russians turn from becoming, you know, very good friends one minute to becoming the enemies the next? You know, and then when it suits, then they're our best friends again. And of course, the Russians do it up to the Americans and to NATO countries. Now, I've met Russian people, I've met American people. I don't see that much difference. You know, people are human beings at the end of the day. It's about time we stood up to our governments when they came out with this sort of stuff and says, oh, hang on a minute. You know, what are you basing this on? And we actually took civil action to ensure that our countries are governed justly and in the interests of us, the people of our countries.
Paul, you know, sorry to interrupt you because I said I wanted you to finish up, but I have to say something about Russia. You mentioned, why were they suddenly enemies? Well, if you look at the history, most people don't know this in America, but the history is they were our friends when the drunken Yeltsin agreed with Reagan that they could come, we could come in, our industrialists, our corporatists, our gigantic industrialists could come in and make deals with the criminals who basically stripped the Soviet Union of all its assets. And they all got rich, and so they were all good friends. And as soon as Putin started standing up for Russian interests and calling some of these criminal oligarchs to task and throwing one of them in prison, all of a sudden, Russia was the bad guy because it was undemocratic. You know, democracy means let the rich rule, right?
So. It's the exploitation of democracy. If we had true democracy, we would all benefit. But the reality is that a lot of what we call democracy, it's a label applied to, as you say, corporate interests, the interests of the few who have, and they screw those who don't.
Yeah, it is the opposite of democracy. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people get upset when you say that America is supposed to be a democracy. They say, no, it's supposed to be a republic. Well, what does that mean? That means rule by the elite. How is that a good thing? Maybe the Constitution is not written by God. Maybe it was written by human beings, and maybe it needs to be changed a little bit. Maybe we do need to try democracy. They use the word all the time, but it's not what they mean, and democracy does not exist in the U.S. or anywhere in the West.
To be honest, I mean, even if they went back to the principles of the Founding Fathers and actually lived by and implemented them, then a lot of these problems would be resolved. The problem is that that's being just used, they pay lip service to it, but they don't really care about those principles. The people that are in power, and certainly the corporate interests, don't care about it. Corporate interests exist to make profit. And while there are some good businessmen out there, you know, that's their main motive, and they don't care who they squash or roll over in the process.
You're right, and I've got to cut you off there because we're out of time, but that's a perfect point, because what you're saying is, a government can be taken over by wealthy corporatists, or it can be taken over by a religion. And either way, that's not a good thing when people are doing that to further their own interests. But it's not about the religion. It's not that corporations are evil. It's that these people are not being held responsible. And that's what we got to do. Quit fighting each other over things like religion and political differences, and work together to establish real democracy in the United States and elsewhere. Paul Salahuddin Armstrong, thank you so much for being with us again. That's it this week for Taking Back America.